Welcome back to the Stratcom podcast. I'm delighted that today we're joined by Dr. Gunders Bergman-Skoratz, who is not only a great person, but also the senior expert on AI at the NATO Strategic Communications Center of Excellence. Dr. Bergman-Skoratz holds a PhD in automatics and signal processing from the University of Lorraine and has extensive professional experience in the private sector, international organizations, and academia. Dr. Bergman-Skoratz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting.
So with AI, as with any technology really, it is not in itself the kind of end product that presents risk. Rather, when placed in human hands, it bears the potential for misuse and abuse. Could you perhaps outline for our listeners how we should even begin to think about the potential risks and opportunities offered by AI as a technology?
Yeah, so AI is an umbrella term for huge family of different methods based on the data that are called machine learning. And so usually people refer to AI, but actually they think about the different methods which corresponds to this machine learning family. And indeed, over the last period of time, we have seen a really exponential growth of different fantastic use cases and demonstrations, as it happened with the deepfakes as well in 2017. And if we look back a little bit on earlier times, like in early 2004, where the Web 2.0 approximately at that time was introduced, we saw that there is a huge potential how we interact with information with the internet itself. And the Web 2.0 allowed us to ensure the two-way communication with the internet. So we were able suddenly to post blogs and post comments in social media and so on. So the social media companies evolved. And then a lot of users were attracted to these companies, and the users generated huge amount of behavioral data. And the amount of the data that has been generated since then is just exponential. And this sparked a new debate about the efficiency of different algorithms, because you have to host somewhere the data, you have to process them efficiently, and you have to do it fast, right? So in order to ensure a good service to the customers. And this also sparked the rapid development of these so-called machine learning algorithms. And since then, we have seen several cases where smart recommendation systems has been abused, where inauthentic text has been generated that looks like a human written text generated by state-of-the-art artificial intelligence algorithms. And we have seen also these talking heads, deepfakes. We have seen cases of voice cloning as a threat of cybersecurity and so on. So there are many cases where it can be used and misused.
Thank you for this. Maybe let's explore this a bit further, this potential applications of AI for creating and spreading disinformation. So do you say that AI can be used to make disinformation more believable, or to make it more profitable perhaps, or cheaper to create, or maybe even more effective to spread? Which of these avenues do you think is more dangerous?
Yeah, so the phenomenon of disinformation, fake news, voice impersonation and person impersonation is not a new phenomenon. So it has been around already for a while, and Photoshop has been used to create a fake imagery and to manipulate imagery. There are different softwares used to manipulate videos and alter the voices and so on. So this is not a new phenomenon. But what people are afraid of is this exaggeration of the use cases, of different use cases that AI will enable these malicious actors to scale up their operations.
And are these fears valid? Should we be afraid of this?
Up to this point, I was quite modest about this. And I was always skeptical about these capabilities, because there were a lot of technical challenges if you wanted to scale this up. So what we did is, in one of our research, we analyzed different videos posted by pro-Kremlin accounts shortly before they invaded Ukraine, during the invasion, and shortly after. And what we found out is that this technology was used sporadically. And there was no clear pattern that they are consistently using these AI manipulations on in their video or image.
But there were some cases, for example, the famous video of President Zelensky allegedly telling soldiers to stand down and to surrender. So there were some cases, but you're saying they're not part of like a systematic pattern or behavior.
Yeah, that particular case is quite interesting because it was a low quality deepfake and it was relatively easy for general audience to detect. And so it is relatively easy for different companies and different social media platforms to detect these type of videos. And this is interesting because if they would really try to push it at scale, these videos, this type of specific videos, they would reveal all their infrastructure as well, right? So it would be a clear pattern and clear red flag for all the companies, for all the debunkers and so on, that like this specific of these social media accounts corresponds to this information campaign, and it would be easier to attribute them. And as it was aggressively debunked and mocked by the Western audience, they see that there is no efficiency in this. It fired back them really fast.
We surely don't want to just reproduce this kind of lazy doom and gloom narratives that AI is only risk and danger. From my understanding, there's also a lot of potential to use AI to fight disinformation and to counter it. Some say that AI could be a game changer for the journalistic profession in general. Do you share this assessment?
In a way, yes. I think that currently at this very stage where you have access to these OpenAI's ChatGPT, for example, the communicators is one of the biggest winners here, because you can generate high quality content in different languages pretty fast by providing different facts and by describing the tone you want to generate some sort of a social media post and so on. So this is a quite a good opportunity for all of the communicators, basically. But there are many other really useful cases where it can be applied, because what is a game changer in this specific technology is the capability of reasoning, capability of understanding specific aspects of language, much more granular understanding of sentiment. And so basically the more reliable opinion mining and so on, these are really crucial steps when you are assessing the information environment around you, especially in military.
So let's a bit look beyond control of just the information domain and discuss how AI can be leveraged to kind of consolidate political control. And of course, the first association is, these invocations of Orwell and 1984, to the point where I think it's almost become a bit of like an exhausted cliche. But do you think in democracies, there is a legitimate place for AI-powered surveillance or AI-driven security technologies?
Yes, I think I wouldn't use here a specific term surveillance. I would use here a term assessment, what is happening. Because the democracies, we are not targeting specific individuals or groups or anything. We are trying to assess how well the government is doing, how well we are doing, how well our political campaigns are doing. By our, I mean the Western countries, Western governments. And there are many ways where it can be used in a really good way, to put in a good use. And so the most important one is really to use these capabilities to understand holistically what is happening in information environment. And since these large language models have been deployed, a lot of companies relied on these so-called narrow AI models, these traditional BERT, Google BERT models. If you look up in Google, you will find a lot of information about these transformer type of models. And there were a lot of technical limitations for these models and performance limitations as well. And so what is quite a game changer here when you start to move towards these large language models is the capability of understanding different languages. So that's one of the game changers here. So the AI is becoming less English-centric And this is what is needed, actually, because imagine from the military perspective, we want to build resilience, the military resilience. We want to build the capabilities of deploying HIMARS, for example, on the borders. We want to have F-16s patrolling the air. We want to have Abrams tanks that would greatly empower the capabilities of mechanized brigades and so on.
That's quite a shopping list.
Yeah, that's quite a shopping list indeed, yeah. But at the same time, if you are missing out a lot of capabilities in this virtual domain, if you are concentrating on the physical domain, you are missing out a lot in this virtual domain, then to reach for adversary to reach the cognitive domain, which is on top of all these two layers, then it's much easier. And it's easier to polarize the societies and so on. So we have to think about, especially the small countries and like less supported countries like Scandinavians, Baltics and so on, comparing to English, Spanish, and French, for example. So
are you saying that this could be some sort of equalizer or in terms of giving these smaller countries a bit more of a fighting chance in strengthening their resilience?
It's about increasing our current capabilities of understanding what is happening in information environment. It's not still perfect, but taking into account the differences, for example, between the, how to say, the research capabilities in language understanding and natural language processing in Latvia, and if you compare it to, for example, to France or to Germany, then there is a little bit difference here as well, and we have to admit that. And these large language models that have been trained on the global data, on multilingual data, they can give us a little bit the ability or chances to step up in this game and to build something that increases the resilience for our societies here as well. So this is quite crucial.
If we look beyond the democratic world, one of the terms that has recently acquired more and more traction is called techno-authoritarianism. And it's not actually, it sounds cool, but it refers to actually a much darker reality, which is that authoritarian regimes around the world have become increasingly skilled at using these emerging technologies to actually suppress free speech, expand their surveillance powers, and kind of actually power their repression. And not only that, but they also increasingly collaborate with each other in terms of exporting these technologies and tools to one another. So for instance, Chinese mass surveillance technology is now increasingly used in Belarus, just as an example. Could you discuss a bit more the potential risks of authoritarian states or totalitarian regimes gaining hold and developing their own expertise in AI?
Yeah, this is also quite interesting aspect, because when you look at these specific countries, let's consider Iran, China, Russia. If you just do a little bit searches and find out what are their government priorities in the research industry, you will see which are the fields that they are investing resources in. And for sure, China is investing in language models as well. And they launched this ERNIE AI project, which is supposed to be for a language model for financial bots, to support the financial bots, right? And this capability can be used also a little bit differently, right? Like ChatGPT can be used in different forms as well. And if you look at Russia, before war, they also invested quite a lot in their language models as well. So the computer vision, a lot can be taken from the open source research that has been published by the Western state-of-the-art universities as well. And this gives a really great foundation to build up something which can be put into use in more malicious ways as well. And what is quite interesting, like there is a little bit, you could see it as a sort of a pattern. For example, China is building their own social media platform where you can do everything. You can shop.
Their own shelternet, really, right? Yeah. A sovereign internet as such.
That's one thing. And they have WeChat. And WeChat allows you to gather news, to read the news. It allows you to do the shopping. It allows you to communicate with friends, to have calls, and so on. So this is an app that does it all. And there might be a reason for that, which is quite closed as well. There are no APIs. You cannot access it to monitor what's happening, for example, there, right? So it's being tied to very like containerized. It's very containerized, and you cannot access it from the outside. You have to register and so on. And on the other hand, if you look at Russia, for example, they have Kontakte and Odnoklassniki and all these other competitors to the Western social media platforms, and they encourage, well, I would say they discourage their own populations to use the Western social media platforms to avoid sort of surveillance and data gathering according to their narratives. So this allows them to keep their populations and their chattering and their communications on their own platforms, which gives them leverage to understand what's happening on their with their own populations. And machine learning models, like this language understanding models, sentiment estimations, and so on, this helps them to follow what are different people's opinion, different person, different groups' opinions on specific political narratives and so on. So this is just the tip of the iceberg, and this is just to illustrate how these technologies can be used to tighten the information control and to moderate, to remove the anti-war, for example, narratives and so on. So,
and that, of course, has profound geopolitical implications, right? For instance, in the case of Russia, we see that this information Iron Curtain has only become more and more harsh, right, with all the space for any kind of dissent being really eliminated, international free press being kicked out of the country, Western social media platforms being banned now. And now, as you say, these technologies will only kind of further enable the regime to consolidate control over the information space and by extension over the hearts and minds of the population.
Yeah, I mean, the power is in the data. If you have access to the data, you already have a lot of power. But these AI models, these machine learning, specific machine learning models, this just allows you to get better informed, much faster and much better informed to understand what's happening.
Understood. Perhaps we could also, since we're on the topic of geopolitical confrontation, even conflict, could you perhaps tell us a bit more about the military applications of AI? And I mean, kind of already on the present battlefield, perhaps. Do you see these technologies being used, for example, in Ukraine already?
People talk about using AI in military and future the future of the military. It's okay to think about the automated, fully automated weapons, drones, and so on. But that's not the only thing. That's the physical dimension. And indeed, we will see more and more robotics being used on the battlefield to save soldiers' lives, to do reconnaissance and attack missions, maybe like drone attack missions, more and more efficiently, and so on. But one of the dimensions that are being that's being shaped a lot by this technology is this virtual dimension. And on the battlefield, indeed, a lot is happening on social media platforms and news outlets as well. So here again, I'm referring to these language understanding models and these multimodal models, which allows you to understand what is displayed in the picture, whether the video contains graphics or some really graphics imagery, some violence and so on. So this helps a lot in the battlefield as well, because if you are consistently viewing through all these videos and you are being exposed for a long time period for a really graphic and violent content, that's not really good for well-being, right? And so these technologies assist these analysts and military officers to understand what is happening on this information environment. So basically, it enables slowly to understand holistically all these operational environment.
But so geopolitically speaking, if during the Cold War, of course, we had the space race, and now a lot is spoken about the quantum race. Do you believe there's a similar contestation between the West and China and Russia and other actors to reach a certain threshold of competence in these technologies for geopolitical purposes?
I think so too, yeah. That's why they put a lot of accent, and that's why they talk a lot and about different cutting-edge technologies being used by the government, because this allows them to to position themselves as the consumers of this cutting edge technology, which already says a lot about their capabilities, potential capabilities, right? But still, I think, and I'm quite sure about Western AI capabilities being like holding the edge right now in the technology still. But we cannot underestimate our enemies, right? Because they don't have any regulations regarding the GDPR. They don't have any regulations regarding these digital markets and so on. So they can much more freely abuse their own population's generated behavioral data to model something, to develop their own AI systems without thinking about different specific restrictions.
So enough about war, enough about conflict. I think in the final stage of our conversation, let's discuss a bit the ramifications of the growing role and application of AI in our everyday life. And of course, one of the overarching concerns that people bring up is that AI will escalate or exacerbate discrimination by reproducing the biases of its human engineers, right? Is there anything that can be done to fundamentally overcome this, or is this just inherent to AI?
No, it's sort of an old problem in the field of artificial intelligence to have non-biased data sets to train your models. And I think the first thing that should be done is establishing a really clear accountability. Who is responsible for what? And once we talk about the AI systems used by governments, by different organizations that actually can have a negative impact on different societies, groups of societies, then we should refer to them as a high-risk AI, and there should be a really specific rules how these AI models and services are being developed and implemented. And
are you saying this should be done, or is this already in place?
Sort of, it's slowly happening. Let's call it in this way. And the companies like OpenAI, they invest a lot in their own monitoring systems. They have always this human in the loop operator who is following up whether there is happening a misuse of their AI services and so on. And but there have been cases where law enforcement has been using a software. The model is sort of a biased and targets specific minorities more than others. Or in banking systems, there are some reports in media stating that these banking ranking algorithms are actually ranking worse specific gender and so on. So there are use cases already, but we have to learn really fast from them and we have to mitigate these biases. And one of the ways how to do it and this fundamental step where you have to start is actually to have a clear understanding who is responsible for what, because we cannot just blame the algorithm. Someone created it, someone gathered the data together. There have been so many people involved in order to create this type of system. And so we have to have a clear understanding who is responsible for what.
Because it also sounds potentially dangerous to allow just these companies to monitor themselves, right? That certainly could create some sort of vulnerability. So do you think this oversight has to come at the national level or at the EU level in a European context?
Definitely at the EU level, and there is already work happening in this way. But there should be also a global understanding of these biases towards specific minorities, specific groups of people, and race and gender, for example. So there should be both like local regulations and also a global understanding and global consensus how this is being done, especially if the vendor is in the United States, for example, and the consumers are the European population.
So I guess one of the potential added values of this podcast episode would be to contribute to so-called AI literacy, right? Maybe demystifying some of the key questions or risks. How confident are you in the AI literacy of policymakers, of our elected officials?
To some extent, I feel confident. However, these regulations are being developed, like AI Act is being developed, and it's not yet approved by the nations and it's not yet in force. But there is, for example, Digital Services Act, and we have in our center, we have a clear understanding of the main weaknesses and strengths these regulations impose. And there will be a lot of challenges for different countries, for different EU countries, when this will be fully in force. And the main challenge will be actually for each country to define what is legal, what is illegal. And then it will be sort of a quite fragmented understanding across the EU level. And this is what I see from the documents been reading, and this is my understanding, that there will be a lot of challenges for local legal systems, and this communication is still unclear who will communicate with what. And yeah, but it's good that these regulations are being developed and slowly it's happening.
So we've discussed how AI could transform our militaries, how they will require our political systems to evolve. But of course, we need to also acknowledge the very demanding economic adaptation that the widespread use of AI will require. A lot has been said about potential job displacement. You know, I'm already stressing that our director at the NATO Stratcom COE is encouraging the more ambitious use of ChatGPT, so I think I will be out of a job very soon. Could you maybe sketch out how our economic systems will need to adapt?
This is also a really good question, because this also includes one of the misuses that has not been touched yet in this conversation. One of the misuses of this cutting-edge AI technology is using it for stupid and silly purposes. Because there are so many interesting things you can do with this technology.
What are these stupid and silly purposes?
Let's say I'm asking AI, this is what I've seen in different blogs and different forums that people are trying to do these silly prompts, like asking AI to act as a girlfriend or something like that. You know, this is just spending a lot of resources. This requires tremendous amount of computational power. So instead of really learning something, you just spend a lot of queries, you just create a lot of queries to generate the silly content. So this is one thing. And what I want to say with this is that people are losing their own time, because the technology is developing at this ludicrous speed. And this creates a lot of anxiety for people, because it's really hard to keep up. And we see that a lot of work positions are changing, and we have to follow up, and we have to know, and we have to learn how to use this technology. And it's not like this technology will immediately replace many jobs. It will become as a requirement to know how to use it in order to become more productive. So maybe there will be optimizations in specific workplaces in big corporate companies. There will be definitely changes in IT field, where the entry level programmers will have a lot of challenges, you know, and they will have to.
So just like it could be a requirement to know English or to know a programming language, this is the type of requirements that could soon be part of a hiring process.
In some fields, this will definitely become as a standard requirement to know how to use it. And then on top of this, we will just have a better product that we will be able to use. Like, for example, as a simplest example, Google Docs. So Google is developing also their own AI system, this smart assistant called Bard. And it's right now in a test mode, and people in some certain countries, they can access it or through the VPN, and then you can test these models, and you can see that there is a lot of potential when you are creating a document and you are writing a document. Imagine you are writing a meeting minutes, and then you just can ask these smart assistants to create a short summaries that you can send to your boss, for example. Or
I know who will be writing the scenario for next year's podcast.
Definitely, yeah. There is room for that. And but also in military, intelligence officers can use it to understand specific news articles in different languages and generate a MESI or ASCOP type of analysis for intelligence purposes. And there are so many things that we can do. And this particular product created a new job already, which is called the prompt engineering. And there are so many people that regards this as a real job, and they want to work in this as a prompt engineer, which basically this position basically tricks out specific information you want from this AI model. You feed in
so
something.
It's learning about how to ask the most precise questions.
Exactly. And then the prompt engineering will become as a standard requirement in many job positions, like communicators and so on, in order to use with the best purpose, most efficiently, these type of smart assistance systems.
But you know, when you are told something like, go learn coding, it will serve you well in life, or go enhance your AI command or AI literacy, that can still sound very overwhelming. So what would you recommend to me? What is a good starting point? What is the good entry avenue for raising my competence, raising my skills in this field so that I don't end up like a caveman sitting by the fire using rocks to hunt in 2023?
That won't happen for sure. But let's not treat these products as some sort of a black box or magic. We have to be responsible how we use these services. And still, you need Google. You need some sort of a search engine to search how to do certain things. And over time, you can develop like intuition how to interact with these smart assistants. But basically, you can interact with the smart assistant itself, and this is how it will slowly transform the education systems as well. Because remote learning, for example, online learning, these type of smart assistants will allow people to interact in more vivid ways, in more natural ways, and explain what I don't understand. Then the system will start to fill the gaps for you and to provide the information that you really need in order to build your knowledge, right? And then to pile up your knowledge. So basically, let's not treat it as a magic. Let's understand that this still is a software, it's still a machine, large machine learning model, and there are plenty of examples how to use this in the purposeful way. We have to leverage them as much as we can.
Well, thank you for giving me this peace of mind. I think it was really a far-ranging, really, really interesting conversation. Dr. Gunders Bergmann-Skoratz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.